Hello and welcome to another episode of City on a Hill, a podcast about what it means to be a citizen of heaven and a citizen of the United States. We want to encourage Christians to find their tribe in the church and their hope in the kingdom of God, rather than to seek both in the kingdom of man. So with that, let's get to it today.
Well, hello, my name is Eric Estep.
And I'm Scott Reevely.
And this is the City on a Hill podcast, and today we're doing something a little bit different. We're pretty excited about it. We have a special, very special guest on, Chris Starin. If you were to jump to his Twitter account, it would say that he is the novelist behind Cradle Robber. He's a writer and director for the films Bringing Up Bobby and Between the Walls, and a self-described total nerd, so I'm a kindred spirit there. But for our purposes today, he is the host of the Truce podcast. So we invited him on so he could talk with us today.
Thanks for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, we're glad you're here, Chris. So tell me just a little bit. I actually couldn't find it anywhere. Why you picked Truce as the name of your podcast?
Oh, sure. Well, I really wrestled over it, but I started the show shortly after the 2016 election. And a lot of my friends were really angry at each other, regardless of their political stances. Everybody was angry. And so I wanted to call a truce just so we could get together and see how we got here and how we can do better. I think truce is a really good word. We don't use it much anymore. Usually it's like, oh, a truce is a surrender. No, a truce is just, let's just take a break here. Talk about where we are and see if we can bring peace to this without a fight. And I think that's something that we as Christians need to be doing more of in the present era, just calling truces so we can understand why we're angry, because so often we don't even know anymore and why we're fighting and realize that sometimes it's getting in the way of our mission.
Do you feel like that you had that truce come about as you highlighted some of the things you've talked about on your podcast? I mean, have you gotten feedback that people said, yeah, I'm going to stop fighting, or I'm going to chill out for a little while?
Unfortunately, I've mostly confirmed other people's existing suspicions. I would like to say I've changed a lot of minds and I've gotten a lot of great emails. It hasn't been the case. I did just get an email or a notice on Instagram, I think it was, that somebody said that they played one of my most recent episodes for some of their ultra rich friends, and it changed their minds to demonstrate that wealth can actually impact other people. So I was like, oh, I'll take that as a victory. It's mostly hasn't changed a lot of people's minds, but it has either affirmed them or else it has sort of brought them back from the brink of something, like maybe the brink of losing their faith or something, because Christianity, we get so tied up in American Christianity with other things. Christianity plus my political beliefs or whatever, my economic ideas. And then that can really destroy our faith. So there has been some of that, trying to bring people back from the brink of walking away because they see we're tied to something toxic.
I do think that, statistics and things would show one of the chief reasons people are walking away from their faith is the tying of the church and politics together. Yeah. I really liked, actually, in one of your last episodes, your pastors called it the barnacle that attaches itself to the church. And I thought that is really a great, explanation for what is that relationship, I think. So.
Right. And that we can scrape those things off so that we kind of streamline our ship here. I think that's a really good. I did an episode where I investigated or tried to look inside my own local church to see how the last few years have shaped it. And to be talking to my pastors about like how the last few years have been for them and to see tears come into their eyes because it's been so stressful for them. I don't need to tell you that, Scott.
Yeah.
But how stressful it's been for them to try to walk that line of loving people, but also dealing with the crazy that just walks into the office or the articles that people send you that are just conspiracy theories and have no basis of truth. they've really had a hard go of it. So I wanted to present that to the audience, because sometimes we just see pastors as these stoic, like know-it-alls at the front of the building. and they're people, you know, and they get a lot of stress put upon them. So I wanted to kind of demonstrate that.
Yeah, I thought you did. I thought that was really great. And we'll link to that in to Chris's podcast in the show notes. But we just had a new mask mandate this last week here in Oregon. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I basically complained to the church from the front, and people didn't so much thank me for the sermon as for thank you for complaining and letting us know that you're human was kind of their thing. So,
oh, they were glad you were human. That's good to know.
Yeah. I guess so. I was trying not to be, but I couldn't help it. So anyway,
Just jump in? You talked about people responding and people that were maybe losing their faith and yeah, you're helping them. What a great work. Thank you for doing that. I have a special spot in my heart for that. And I'm just really glad that God's using you in that way. So that's just a little aside.
Oh, praise God. Yeah. That's actually my target audience. If I could, would be people who are about to leave the church or people who want to get into the church, but are kind of being deterred by some of the things we're into. So that's kind of my mission field as I see it.
Yeah.
Very cool.
I did notice that probably your earlier episodes had more to do with the church. And I mean, you have multi-level marketing and advertising. You have some different things in there, but more recently it's converged on more political matters. I mean, is that how you see your plan going, or how do you relate to politics there?
Yeah. I mean, some of my first ever episodes were about Donald Trump and is he a believer? Like how do white evangelicals get attached to him? And I just kind of, I started to see patterns as I was working on season two, where I was like, you know, I see people using the word communism or socialism for everything that they don't like. You know, it's like, oh, you know, this, my eggs expired in my refrigerator. That means communist. It's something, you know, that's the communist's fault. And it's like, no, that's not good. I just let the egg sit there too long. But we are now at the place where we can call something communist or socialist and not pay attention to it. Mm. And so I realized that we needed to know what those things were. Or are, I guess I should say, they haven't gone away, but we need to know what they are, and then also see how they have impacted the American church. So I kind of, for season three, took a big chance and thought, well, I'll just tell this one gigantic story that is like, how did communism and socialism impact the American Christian church? And God willing, in season five, I'll be talking about how fundamentalism came about in the United States and the Christian church. I'm working on that right now. My room is surrounded by little cards, little slips of paper with little notes on them. I'm trying to figure out how in the world I'm going to lay all that out in 20 episodes. But yeah, so I switched formats there, and it really helped me a lot to try to tell a much bigger story. But it's a story that is not quite linear, because there are going to be lots of overlapping events. You're talking about sometimes hundreds of years of history. And so there's nobody alive for all that time. You can't just pick one character. So it does to ask a lot of the audience to be able to hang with you and be like, this is going somewhere. I may just be talking about shipping containers at this moment, but you'll see that there's a point, you know, and I've been trying to use like wonder to inspire wonder in the audience to be like, oh, I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. You know, that makes so much sense, so that they'll go with me on this journey. They may take, you know, a year and a half to unravel.
Yeah. Well, that's actually how I found you. I think I looked for something about the Cold War and Christianity and found you. And I'm really thankful for that. But the Cold War is near and dear to my heart. I mean, I grew up in the Cold War.
Yeah.
And I, to this day, think Rocky IV is the best Rocky movie. And I mean, I competed overseas in Iran. I wrestled in Iran.
Oh.
And back then, the real excitement was not that I went to Iran, but that I was within 1 mile of the border, the Soviet Union border.
Wow.
Which was, you know, then that made everyone, you know, in my family uptight, because my dad was a fighter pilot and he sat alert guarding the Montana Canadian border in case the Russians flew over. So I grew up in a household that was really entrenched in the Cold War. And so, yeah, I was really, really fascinated by what you did there. I mean, how would you define the Cold War for our audience so they know what we're talking about here?
Oh, yeah. So it was basically the idea that, by the way, I should say that I live, Rocky IV is the one where he trains in Russia, right?
Yes, right. Where he fights Ivan Drago.
Right. So when he's running past the snow-covered mountains, I live just a few miles from where they filmed that, which is funny that you say that. So
oh, nice. Awesome.
Yeah. A little connection right there.
So you live in Russia? What's going
no,
on?
No, no. I live in Jackson, Wyoming. Yeah, those mountains. I think he stays in a cabin out in the woods, too.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That, the cabin's no longer there, but it was just a few miles from where I am right now. But anyway, diversion. So the Cold War... was essentially when the United States was afraid that communist Russia was going to attack. And a lot of that had to do with nuclear weapons. We were afraid that, of the weapons that they had, they were afraid of our weapons. And so it was cold because there wasn't a whole lot of actual fighting that went on. It wasn't like a hot war where we're, shooting at each other, but it was mostly based on fear and what could happen. And a lot of that, what actually happened was messaging that went back and forth. So after 1917, when the Russian Revolution happened and the czars were overthrown in Russia, you start to have guys like Lenin and then Stalin come into power, who had a very tight control over their people and used communism to try to turn the society around and often used brutality to enforce communism. And so the United States took part in trying to, well, first of all, we partnered with them during World War II. And some would say that Russia won World War II, but we won't go there too deeply. After World War II was over, we settled into this battle with Russia that we were enemies. And it stayed that way until the Berlin Wall fell in, I want to say, 89?
89, yeah.
Yeah. And... when were the Rocky movies?
Would have been the late 80s.
Yeah.
The first, yeah, I think.
Probably.
Right, which is why the Rocky movie was not filmed in Russia.
Right, exactly. Right. But it's one of those things. It's a really interesting period where you've got a lot of hyped up fear, but you've got a lot of things that were actually worth being afraid of. And that was one of the lines I tried to walk in my series. I started out the whole series trying to explain what went on in Russia, the fall of the czars, what the role of the church had been, because there were Christians in Russia, and then build up to the various persecutions, the millions and millions of people dying. And I could have gone into China and discussing how many people died there, but I didn't want to get waylaid too much. But it was a real threat, and they really did have nuclear weapons. And so we have to walk this interesting line of not saying, oh, the people who were afraid of Russia were just a bunch of rubes, because there was an actual thing to be afraid of. And they really were pushing atheism, and there was a hatred of God. There were two different magazines in Russia called Godless, and there were posters up that showed, and I have an episode about this, where you can see there were posters up that characterized Christianity as backwards thinking and outdated and anti-modernist and that kind of thing. And so there was a lot of propaganda in Russia against Christianity, seeing that as sort of like a thing that held people back, held society back. And at the same time, we in the United States were advertising that Russia was backwards, and that if you wanted to be an American, you would go to your church or synagogue. So actually, like the Ad Council, who we know is like the people behind Smokey Bear and the crash test dummies and anti-smoking campaigns, were actively putting out campaigns that said go to church or a synagogue. And then you have the rise of the National Day of Prayer and the National Prayer Breakfast, God being on the money, God being in the Pledge of Allegiance. All that kind of happened around the same time in the early 1950s, as we were trying to fight sort of godless communists.
And, one of the ways that I think about this is that the United States and Christianity had somewhat of a common enemy.
Right.
This communistic atheism for the church and this nuclear Soviet Union for the United States. And so we were able to direct it, if we were together, the church and the country, we could better defend ourselves in, right. or at least prepare ourselves for this potential threat.
Right. Absolutely. And it was, it was one of those things that guys like, you know, Billy Graham could use to kind of bring people to the reality of your life is going to end someday and you're going to have to meet your creator. Hmm. Would you come to him now? Would you have build a relationship with your creator? And so even early in his career in the, I want to say early 1950s, Billy Graham was using threats of nuclear war in his speeches to kind of bring an immediacy to the evangelism campaigns, but then also to make people aware of what was going on in Russia and what the potential was. So Christianity and sort of the anti-communist movement were very much tied together, for better or for worse, maybe a little bit of both at the same time. Yeah. And we're really bad at non-binary things. We want to believe that the anti-communist movement was all good or it was all bad, but it's really a combination of both. Hmm. And that's, we're bad at that.
Well, and I right. appreciate you trying to not just resort to caricature, but go into those nuances. I'm listening through season three. I'm digging it. It's fantastic. I love the, it's like history with some Planet Money or Radiolab vibes, because you're always bringing in extra audio. But I really do appreciate the nuance. Let's talk about this. This could be a truly bad thing here, and then there's a bit of good here, and then you just keep walking through. So I think that's helpful. And anyone listening in, they should definitely check that out for sure.
I you know, the greatest compliment I can get is that's like Planet Money. one of my favorite shows, and actually I interview for season five, I interview Jacob Goldstein.
Oh, nice.
Who's one of the hosts of Planet Money. He'll be on an episode about the gold standard coming up in season five, God willing.
Very fun.
Yeah, little teaser for that.
Very fun.
Good. Well, what, I mean, you've talked about Billy Graham and God We Trust being on our money and that sort of thing. There were other things happening here at the same time that sort of marshaled a moral majority, you might say, with respect to abortion and some other things. I mean, how did that play in with this, I don't know, fear of atheism, fear of communism?
Oh, well, I mean, the idea, whew, gosh, it depends on how far you want to go back on all that stuff. We get into the modernist fundamentalist debate.
You're thinking like 70s, right, Scott? 70s, 80s?
Yeah, it was rose at the end of the 70s, yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can go with that, which is the tough thing, because there's so many different things going on. Because a lot of what happened with the segregation debate, abortion, came out of segregation. Because when schools were being integrated in the 60s and 70s, schools like Bob Jones University were being forced to integrate, and they didn't want to integrate. And so they eventually begrudgingly integrated in a way where as you could integrate as long as people didn't mix races in dating. You know, you couldn't have a Black student dating a white student, which was, let me just go on the record and say, very stupid. very stupid thing. Very backwards thinking. So after the segregation stuff, that's really when abortion took over, because we needed something to be afraid of. We needed something to, come together about, because pre-moral majority time, like the 70s, 80s, abortion wasn't as big of an issue in the United States. And if it was talked about, it was more like a gray area than it was a black and white area. But then we needed a common enemy. And as you guys have talked about on some of your other episodes, fear is something that sells. You know, if you want people to get on board with something, you get them afraid of it. And the fear of abortion really took hold there. Because, and like weirdly, since Roe v. Wade was put in, abortions have actually gone down in the United States, even though they were made legal. So it's a very complicated issue, the abortion thing. but it does kind of go into that idea. As the Cold War was waning, we needed something else to be afraid of.
Because as the Cold War was waning, then the moral majority too sort of ended. And, yeah. That whole... Then we have the 90s until 2001, when there was 9/11, and
right.
We all of a sudden got a new common enemy and sort of did a refresh on
Well, I mean, fear? We also had the Clintons in the 90s. There was a big fear of that with Monica, the whole Monica Lewinsky scandal and all that. And Democrats are, you know, the phrasing was always like Democrats are sliding backwards and don't care about American morals. And of course, then you look at Donald Trump, who, you know, well, even Reagan was a divorcee. Right. Donald Trump was a divorcee and also, you know, publicly bragged about cheating on his wife. Mm-hmm. So we kind of abandoned that. But yeah, we did eventually move on to Islam. That old tried and true little nugget.
Yeah, that one's really tried and true, isn't it?
Yeah.
So what, as you're, you know, as you think about, you've obviously thought about this a lot, which I appreciate very much. And as you think about it, I mean, you've got several different planks that are, were important in the Cold War, but are still here.
Yeah.
This, you've got, I mean, you mentioned that the first thing that attracted you to the Cold War was sort of the shine, the glimmer of this gold vein that was, everything's called socialism, everything's called communism.
Right.
And that sort of drew you there. But we've got that. We've got, you know, continued fear on the part of people who are, you know, trying to engage church members, let's say, who are trying to engage ideas in the broader world. They're afraid of everything, right, as far, or they're made to be. Other people want them to be afraid of everything. What way forward do you see for the church in how we might move, kind of move past the common enemy problem or the fear problem? How do we do that? How do we move far forward there?
Yeah, I think the main thing is just when you, I think you guys were talking about this in your previous episodes, the main thing is that notice when you're being sold to. Mm-hmm. If we can get Christians to be more aware of that, I think we'll win a lot of these battles. You know, when somebody's trying to sell you something, just calm down. If they're trying to make you afraid, calm down. Is this really something I should be afraid of? Is this something that's really new in the world? Or is this something that's existed? Is somebody trying to make money off of me, being afraid, that kind of thing? But I also think that one of the main things is that when Jesus is asked, what is the most important commandment? He says, you know, love the Lord your God with all your heart, everything you've got, and also love your neighbor as you love yourself. And it turns out that we're generally, as Christians, good at one or the other, but we're terrible at both. And so I think that if we can get focused on doing both again, I think that would save us a lot of trouble. And trying to understand that a lot of these things that are going on have been going on for a very long time. And if you study history, as I've only in the last, you know, few years started doing, you start to see that as you look into an issue and you're like, when did this issue begin? You're going to go back further and further and further and further and realize, oh, this didn't begin now. It didn't begin 10 years ago. It began 200 years ago or whatever. And so a lot of our things, even like the troubles in Afghanistan right now, we like to have a very limited view and say these things happened in 2001. That's not even close to true that when all this right. began. But that's, you know, because we like to have little sound bites. We hold on to those things being recent. Those are the main things. Yeah. Calm down whenever somebody's trying to sell you something, but then also focus on the real mission, which is loving the Lord and loving our neighbors. And if we can do that, I think we can go really far.
Yeah. When you said it's gone on longer than you think, and then you brought up Afghanistan. So I did read somewhere somebody that said nobody's really figured out Afghanistan since Alexander the Great.
Right. Maybe even before that. Yeah. Who knows?
Possibly, but that gives you some
old problem, you
know, perspective. You're right.
Right. I mean, bare minimum start in the 70s with Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's even short term. I love the quote is, time may not be cyclical, but at least repeats itself. And that's just right. So evident with so many things. Even we're sitting in a pandemic. I've heard people go, oh, we're in a pandemic. I just finished a book about the 1918 pandemic.
Yeah.
It's like we've done all this before and all the arguments were the same and everything was the same. And to get a little bit of historical really perspective is so helpful in engaging, engaging whatever's coming at us as a church, as individuals, all of it. So that's helpful.
Yeah, I think the worst word of 2020 and 2021 was unprecedented, because almost everything that people said was unprecedented had total precedent. And totally. I even had somebody say something about like, oh, the mask mandates, and she lives in Canada. the mask mandates in Canada are unprecedented. And it's like, but listen, no, they're not. Mask mandates are not unprecedented. And she was like, well, I'm talking about in the last few years and only in Canada. I was like, well, that's not how precedent works. You know, like, you know, nobody has ever planted a rose bush. I mean, just in my neighborhood. No, I mean, just in my block, nobody's planted a rose bush in my block. That means it's unprecedented. Yeah. This week. No, I mean, precedent is looking through history and time and, you know, geography. But we don't like that, you know, but it does take a lot of work, and I can appreciate why we're so jumbled up, because you think about how complex the modern world is, and the things that, you know, parents are supposed to know how to do for their children, and know also about the technology they're supposed to limit and be informed about every, you know, everything that's going on in every country. It's a lot to take in. So I would also say we need to have compassion for people who are different than us, people who maybe are overreacting. Because they just don't know. You know, they're upset, they're angry, they're afraid, because everybody's been telling them to be angry, upset, and afraid. And so we need to respond with compassion and not just, you know, write our neighbors off as idiots. You know, that doesn't do us any good either.
That's very much not loving our neighbors.
Very
to
much,
go back
yeah.
to the first point, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but it's easy. I'm drawn in that way. You know, I drive a school bus for a living when I'm not podcasting. And I'll tell you, anger is my first nature. It takes actual effort to love my neighbor when they cut me off in a school bus, you know, and I'm driving a school bus. But that's my duty as a Christian, is to love my neighbor.
Yeah. I think it's hard for the church to carve out a, you know, non-American identity.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what drew me back to the Cold War, when their identities, the identity of the church in America, got enmeshed a little bit. And I that's why I really liked that last episode of your podcast when you interviewed your pastors, because
yeah.
I think we've got to figure out a way to help the church with an identity that is, I don't know, transnational rather than simply American. And that it's God's eternal kingdom that we're part of, more than a democratic republic that's a few hundred years old.
Right. Or just worrying about our country or our kinds of people. Yeah, that's hard to do.
Yeah. And so I don't know if you've got anything for the church on that, how they can essentially construct maybe a new identity as God's church instead of an American church?
I would say, like, start out just reading history of another country, maybe. So I got really into studying French history and talking about Napoleon, reading about Napoleon. I've got a very large book right here. In fact, I can show you guys, you can't see this on audio, but like a 1,000-page book here about Napoleon. And one of the reasons I like talking about him and this book is that learning history of another country will give you compassion for that country and give you perspective. Even in this giant book about Napoleon, there's several sections about Christianity and the way he manipulated Christianity and things. And you can get a bigger perspective outside of the United States, because most of us, all we really know is from 1776 to present day in the United States, you know, skipping World War I, because nobody knows what that was about. And, you know, skipping the Spanish-American War. And it's a very limited view of history. But if you can broaden that idea of history, I think it gives you compassion for other people and other places. So that's helped me a tremendous amount.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. And I don't know how we kind of landed on it, Eric, but I think one of our first things was we just said, let's do sort of a flyby on church history, because one of the things that we found is that everyone was longing for the good old days of the church, when the church was all set, you know, in the, I don't know, in the 90s or in the 50s or in the...
That's not true.
It's not true at all, no. And we just, ours was a much higher, much less detailed and nuanced way of describing it than you've done, Chris, but that was really interesting to realize that the church has been struggling with this, you know, enmeshment with politics since at least since Constantine.
So. Yeah, and you know, we've been lamenting for a long time. So I'm researching the 1920s, and they're having these church meetings about how men don't participate in churches anymore, and you know, we're backsliding, we're losing our moral bearings and stuff. And this is 1920. This is 20 years ago or 100 years ago, and it's the same complaints that we have right now. You know, 1870s, they were worried about the same things that we are now. Mm-hmm. Which is really fascinating, because we tend to look back and say that those people really had it figured out in the 1800s. I did some episodes a few years ago about the temperance movement, mm-hmm. you know, the move to try to ban alcohol. And in the 1830s, I want to say it was the average American drank something like three times what they do now. So we look at that era as like this very chaste, pure area, Little House on the Prairie and all that. It's like, well, imagine three times the alcohol consumption of now. Add that to Little House on the Prairie, you know. But we have, so since we have such a very limited view of history, we tend to like glorify the past, and that isn't necessarily helpful. Hmm.
No, thank you. Yeah, thank you for that. And I think just keep at it, Chris. I think if
you keep
you know, holding out for the church, the history, the, you know, especially the American history, I think that's a big part of it. Yeah. And I think church history too. I can't, mm-hmm. we've had people here with respect even to mass mandates go all the way back to the Reformation and ask us to defy the tyrants, you know.
Really?
Yeah, and there's some church history people need to know too, really, in addition right. to the national and political history for sure.
Well, I'd be curious, because the Bible does say we are supposed to obey our earthly leaders. How have your congregations dealt with that?
When it comes, Eric, to masks? You want to go with this one?
Sure. Yeah, you're referring to Romans 13, of yeah. course. And I will say in general things, I just led a leader meeting, I think that was a month or so ago, and asked people to ponder what they've learned in the last 18 months. Yeah. And someone said, and there was heads nodding in agreement, that they knew how to submit in theory before this pandemic started, but they didn't know how to submit in practice. And yeah. that's something that God had given them during this time, is how to submit. It's hard. It's difficult. It's, you don't always like the way rules are being made, or maybe you have a different way of doing it, and you would disagree. But that's where submission comes into play, right? When we actually disagree, and there's many examples of people maybe experiencing that in a difficult way, but learning how to submit when it's hard. And there's definitely been plenty of, I don't like this, and let's figure out how to read Romans in a way that allows me to opt out.
Right.
And we've wrestled with that too. And I'm happy to point to scripture and keep pointing to scripture. And that's what we want to do, but I'm not going to say it's been easy. And there's been a lot of different responses, by a lot of different people.
Yeah. And I will say there have, you know, by and large, people in our church have been very sweet about it and have yeah. been very good. And sadly, with my negativity bias, I'm sure it's not the good responses that I remember or right. that come to mind or that I even talk about, which probably that's a character flaw on my part. But I do think that there have been some really unusual expectations of the church, I think, with regard to, and they go back to the American Revolution, and they go back to the Reformation, and it's just been interesting how people think that we should stand up for our rights as right. Christians.
Well, and as you said with the Revolution, it's kind of an interesting question I proposed a few years ago on my show, was, is revolution biblical? And that's a really tough question to ask, especially in American Christians, because it's very hard to justify the American Revolution biblically. Because Britain wasn't really asking us to do anything evil. Their taxes were high, and that's why we rebelled. You know, we couldn't get representation, but that is not like anti-God in some ways. In fact, we're doing the same thing to our, I'm going to get in deep water. We're doing the same thing to our territories, taxation without representation. It gets into a really sticky place. Is the United States itself biblical? Was it started on a biblical foundation when we're supposed to obey our leaders, but we rebelled? And also there, we don't hear about the stories of all the pastors who were loyalists to British, to the British, but were silenced, and their papers and manuscripts and books and things were burned. So it would look like we were a unified people. And we weren't. Mm-hmm. So it's a really tough thing. We want history to be the way we want it to be. And it rarely lines up with that.
Yeah.
And we were hitting those same topics a while ago, trying to piece all that out. And you've made the same point in your podcast. We like this country. We're glad to be citizens here. But I don't want to look with a strictly romantic view backwards, because that blinds me to mistakes or blemishes or whatever. And I think that's a great caution. If you're reading history, do a full dive and not just do a romantic view of revolution or the beginning of this thing, because it's not a, I think you're talking about a theistic rationalist foundation for the way the founding fathers talked about it, not a Christian or even a deist thing. It's something different that has the flavor of Christianity, but is not, or maybe religion, but not Christianity as a whole.
Yeah, that's, I don't know if maybe you want to flesh that idea out for your listeners, if you guys already done that.
Yeah, we've done that a little bit.
Okay, great. Yeah. Because there is basically, it's this idea that we tend to say the United States was founded by Christians, that, you know, the founding fathers were Christians. But other people will say that they were deists. And the difference is, of course, you know, Christians, we believe that Jesus was an actual being who came to earth, God's son, died on a cross, rose again, and sent the Holy Spirit. So that, you know, we generally believe that as Christians. A deist would believe that God set the world in motion and walked away, which, you know, is not Christianity. And it turns out most of the founding fathers were really neither of those things. They were what Greg Fraser calls, he's at the Master's Seminary, Master's College.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he called it theistic rationalism, the idea that God set the world in motion, stayed involved, but God is not him, or Jesus is not him. And so that was where most of the founding fathers fell into the thing. So to call the United States, say the United States was started by Christians, is not really true. And then we can make the argument from there: is the United States a Christian nation? And that really comes down to, what do you mean by it being a Christian nation? Does it mean that to live in the United States makes me a Christian? No, I mean, that's not how Christianity works. Right. Otherwise, why would we bother evangelizing to anybody who lived here? If simply,
we'll just immigrate.
Right. Yeah, exactly. If simply living someplace made you a believer, you could just move to it and then you'd be a Christian. But that's not how it works. Do you mean that it was founded by Christians? Well, it really wasn't. Do you mean that a lot of people in the United States are Christians? Well, then yes, then that would make sense, because there have historically been a lot of Christians here. So it just kind of depends what people mean by that thing. But we do hold on to that very tight, not realizing that the United States is not the center of the world. Mm. I heard a pastor years ago on a fundamentalist radio broadcast say that the reason that the United States is not mentioned in the Bible is because we're all going to be raptured before the end times happen. Because if we're a Christian nation, we'll be raptured, we'll be out of the picture before the end times happens. Like, what?
I love the argument by silence. That's just fantastic. Yeah, no fallacy there.
Like, how do you even get there? Yeah. Or it could possibly be that the United States is not the center of the universe, you know, and we have a hard time grasping that it's great to live in a country, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be the center of the universe. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily mean the United States has to be pivotal in every decision. It's a great place to live, but it is not, it's not Israel. And the Bible is largely about Israel.
I'm reading Religion in American Culture, A Brief History by George Marsden.
Oh, yeah.
And you have it right there.
Oh, it's in one of my piles. Yeah. Okay. I interviewed him for my next season. Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome. And he makes a really interesting observation about Christianity in America, that before in the colonial times, the institutions were more influenced by Christianity, and the populace was not. I mean, populace was not really churchgoers and that. And then, you know, you can almost flip that upside down when you get into the late 1900s, when now there's a waning influence and more secular institutions like schools and government and that, and the populace goes to church, which I thought, right. I'd never heard anybody make that argument, but I thought that's one of the things I think that people pine for when they look back on the good old days.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, surely institutions have a more of a mark of Christianity on them.
I mean, but yeah, it's tough because you always want to ask, when do you think the good old days were? Like, if somebody's wearing a Make America Great Again hat, I always want to say, like, when do you think it was great? Mm-hmm. Because it may be that the era you're thinking of was relatively new. So mm-hmm. a lot of that kind of comes down to the 1950s, which is another reason I wanted to focus on that, mm-hmm. Which, you know, was not all that long ago. It was just 70 years ago. And depending on who you were, it may not have been a great time for you. you know, if you were a person of color, if you were a woman, if you lived outside the United States, you know, like you happen to live in, say, Guatemala. I did a whole season about, or a series or episode about Guatemala and our treatment of them in the 1950s. Mm. And we were just coming off of this big boom after World War II. And it only lasted for a little while. I mean, you start to see the decline of the boom in the 80s. So it's maybe 30 years of the good old days. Mm-hmm. When even now, like I still see that mentality of like, if you work hard, you can go get a good factory job and work at that factory until you die. It's like, well, that hasn't been true for a long time. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't true before the 1950s. You know, but that mentality that has always been that way has been with us for a long time. Whereas things like, again, God being on the money, he wasn't really permanently on the money until the 1950s. Mm-hmm. He wasn't in the Pledge of Allegiance until the 1950s. National Day of Prayer, National Prayer Breakfast, those didn't start until the 1950s. So really, for the majority of the United States history, those things didn't exist. Ten Commandments monuments weren't everywhere. They were put up as partially as a marketing campaign for the movie, The Ten Commandments, which is like a ridiculous thing to think about when you hear about it. And, but we see those things that seem to have been there forever and assume that they have been, when that's not the case. I mean, you look at, some of the scandals from the 1800s that happened, like the Teapot Dome scandal out here in Wyoming, happened. Us getting into the Spanish-American War that we really didn't have a whole lot of business getting involved in, empire, slavery, of course. And, you see that the era, the good old days may not have been so great. If you look with just blinders on, they seem really perfect. So even like when my friends and I go on hikes and things, we try to make conversation so we don't notice how much our feet hurt. We end up asking each other, like, what era would you have lived in if you could live in one? And ultimately, we generally settle on, like, I would live in the last 20 to 30 years. And that's as far back as I would go. And
that's pretty convenient because that's where you are, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Well, good, Chris. Great. No, I appreciate your thoughts and your input on this for the church, because I think, you know, I think that this is one of the key issues, I would say, at least in the top five of things that are going to influence the church in the next 5 to 10 years, that we're going to have to come to grips with how we see ourselves in the world, how we see ourselves with politics,
right,
and what it's going to take for us to get our, you know, our feet on the ground and represent Jesus in this world. Right. It's going to come down to how do we see ourselves with respect to political institutions and that sort of thing. And so you've been very helpful to me on that.
Oh, I hope so. Yeah. Praise God. Yeah. I think it all comes down to loving God and loving our neighbors. And I think the rest of it will take care of itself, honestly.
Well, you can sure do worse than that. So thank you. Yeah.
That's a great last word. Well, before we wrap this up, can you tell our listeners how to find you online or connect with you?
Sure. Yeah. You can find all about the Truce podcast anywhere you get podcasts, and that's T-R-U-C-E podcasts. You can see my films Bringing Up Bobby and Between the Walls. They're on Amazon Prime and also on YouTube. And I think they're going to be coming to Hoopla if you have the Hoopla app. I have a novel called Cradle Robber that you can get on just about any ebook store. And all that information is at trucepodcast.com.
Well, thank you again, Chris Stern. It's been a pleasure to talk with you and chat through these things. And I'm glad the Venn diagram had a lot of area where we can talk about this stuff. And I'm glad we're doing this stuff together. It's great.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for coming on. And I want to remind everyone else, don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts for our podcast, wherever you get podcasts, and rate us. If you find what we're doing helpful, a review would go a long way to getting this to other people. And share it with a friend. If you have questions, send them to podcast@newlifenw.com. And we look forward to the next conversation.